This is an Equity Beats Media podcast.
Everything you're about to hear is for education and entertainment purposes only. Whilst we are licensed, we're not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any advice is general advice. Equity Mates operates under Australian Financial Services Licence 540697.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is useful.
Welcome back to Equity Mates Investing, a podcast where we explore what's possible in the world of investing. If you have just joined us for the first time, a huge welcome. My name is Bryce, and today we're actually coming to you live. And
As podcasts can come to you live.
Fair call.
But we did a live show. We took our Ask an Advisor concept and have you introduced me?
No. That's going to redo the whole thing.
No, I'm Ren.
Here's Ren. I'm Bryce. If you've just joined us, you're in for a treat because we are bringing you our live event.
That's right. We've been doing our Ask an Advisor concept on the podcast for about 18 months where we get your questions and we put them to some of Australia's best financial advisors. We know the cost of advice is quite expensive, and so we're trying to bring advisors closer to you. And this was the next step in that journey, our first Ask an Advisor Live, where we brought them so close to you that they were literally in the same room as you.
It was a great experience.
It was really just, as you'll hear, it was the audience's chance to ask their questions to Glenn Hare, who is the co-founder of Fox & Hare, a financial advice firm that really focuses on accumulators, young people in their 20s, 30s and 40s who are trying to, I guess, set a solid foundation for their financial lives.
Yeah. So this was an awesome evening. It was a sold out event. We are planning to do this at other destinations around Australia. So stay tuned. We'll let you know when our tickets become available. It was a really fun night. A big shout out and thank you to Glenn. If you would like to speak to Glenn and his team, head to equitymates.com/advice and we'll be able to connect you.
And here's a fun little bonus thing for any advisors listening. Glenn let us know after that they're actually looking to hire a new advisor. And so if you're looking for a new job, or if you're an advisor just starting out who is looking for their first job, hit Glenn up on LinkedIn.
Yeah, so we'll put his LinkedIn in our show notes. He just said to DM him to get in touch.
Yeah. So without any further ado, let's jump into the episode. This is a recording of our live show with Glenn Hare, Equity Mates Ask an Advisor Live.
So for those regular listeners on Equity Mates, Glenn has been on the show a couple of times and has really resonated with our audience. We've done two Ask an Advisors with him and continuously get questions submitted by you guys. So the Slido that you just used, you'll see on the top left, there's polls and there's also a Q&A part or section. This is where we're going to get you guys to just submit your questions as we go through the night. We're not going to have a roving mic or anything. You'll be able to upvote questions as well as you see them come through if you'd really like us to answer them. So we'll be kind of keeping track of this on our phones and give you the opportunity to ask as many questions as you like. Glenn, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I guess before we kick off, do you just want to, for those who haven't come across you and the team before, just give us a quick intro to yourself?
Sure. Background, grew up in Sydney, started at Macquarie Bank when I was 19, co-founded Fox & Hare when I turned 30. Business has grown from 2 people to 16, and we provide advice to predominantly people between the ages of 25 and 45, so biggest differentiator, I suppose, is we don't work with pre and post retirees. When the average age of an advised client, so someone that has a financial advisor in Australia, is 58. I live between Tasmania and Sydney with my partner, Liam, who's in the room, and our greyhound, Larry.
Nice. Love that.
Now, while everyone gets used to Slido, upvotes questions, we've got some of our own to start things off. And we wanted to start with a bit of a speed round. This or that, we'll give you two options. You tell us which one you'd prefer. All right, let's start with, I guess, what a lot of people dream of. Retire early or a four-day work week?
Four days.
Why is that?
I love work. I love what I do. So I I couldn't see myself doing nothing, I suppose. I see work as a hobby. It's hard sometimes, but I do enjoy it.
You're living the best life.
Some days. Ask me next week. I could say something completely different.
So one that we often get when people start their journey or thinking about investing, property or shares?
Shares.
Again, why?
You can start early. Property, particularly where we are, is very expensive. And I love the fact that, you know, regardless of your position, you can start pretty young.
The most common question we get at Equity Mates is, what broker should I sign up with? And the debate always descends into CHESS sponsored, non-CHESS sponsored. So, CHESS sponsored or custodial broker?
Custodial.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it just gives, there's more flexibility and more access to kind of international cost comes into it. But that's probably one I'm more on the fence with.
And then final speed round question, credit cards for the points or no credit cards at all?
No credit card. Controversial, I know. Why? Because research suggests that those that have credit cards, even if you have never paid interest in your life, will on average spend about 20% more. So without going into detail, for our members that love credit cards and love the points and that's okay, we often look to quarantine that just for their bills or just for, you know, the big expenses, and the day-to-day isn't the continual tapping, because that's very hard to track.
How do you set up your portfolio? And I guess, do you have any financial goals or things that you're working on this year that you can sort of talk us through?
Yeah. So the first thing I think about when I think about money is the goals, like what is it that we're actually working towards. So my partner and I, at least once a year, we'll go away, and we did this only a couple of months ago down in Tassie on the east coast, if you've been there, in Freycinet. We went camping, we took the laptop, and we drank a lot of wine and ciders and had a spreadsheet open that had all of our goals that we want to achieve this year, and we also reflected on what we had achieved over the previous year. So whenever thinking about money, it's always about, okay, well, what are we actually trying to achieve? On kind of a day-to-day basis, we do have, you know, the bucket style system, and, you know, the buckets are great, but they are different for different people. When I think about a portfolio, although I said shares, I'm a firm believer in you can also make money from property, and also, you know, make money in a really tax-effective environment like your superannuation. So when I think of the term portfolio, I don't go straight just to our, I guess, equity portfolio. I think about it as a broader view. And yeah, every financial decision that we make, regardless of what it is, it's always about, okay, well, how is this going to get us to where we want to be from a life perspective? Because if you're building a portfolio or paying down debt or setting up buckets and you're not really sure if it's going to get you to where you want to be from a life perspective, then it's not very aspirational, I suppose.
So, Glenn, we've got a number of questions coming in, and there's some that are getting some great upvotes. So I think we'll kick straight into it.
Right.
Obviously, we appreciate that you haven't seen these questions. So this one's come in from Pac-Man Suit.
Who could that be?
So this one is, I don't want to buy property. What are the risks? What risks are there with not buying property until we retire? And maybe more broadly, with the clients that you see coming in who are finding it challenging to buy property and trying to overcome that anxiety.
Yeah, so property isn't the be-all and end-all. You can make money other ways. What I have seen when it comes to property, it is often an emotional investment, and sometimes it's when people get to a point where maybe they find a partner or they start a family, and that's, and I have seen the shift from those that have been very adamant that property isn't something they want to do, when they get to that stage, like, oh, maybe this is something that I want to do. And often that's like, are we close to local schools and you know, things like that. In terms of the risk of not investing in property, and this is a broad generalization, but In terms of mortgages in Australia, the default rate on mortgages in Australia is very, very low. It still is very low after the last, 12, 13 rate rises that we've had. Australians will do anything to make sure that they make their mortgage repayments, and that may be one, two, three jobs. The challenge I see when it comes to a stock portfolio, which is often you kind of go property or shares, is that one of the biggest pros around having the flexibility is also can be a real con, because what I mean by that is if you're regularly investing, $500, $1,000, $2,000, whatever it is per month, it's very easy to stop that. So if you wanted to have a big, blowout trip to Europe, you just don't invest for a couple of months. If you want to buy a new car, you just don't invest for a couple of months. And that has a compounding impact, whereas if you've got a property, you have no choice. You've got to make that mortgage repayment. So it's about if you're going down the stock route, and I love both. We're investing in property, we're invested in the stock market, but you've got to be really disciplined with the stock piece, and it's something you've got to be consistent with.
I think one of the challenges... One of the challenges as well is we're in a society where property is like front of mind for everyone. It makes the headlines in newspapers, and there's this fear of FOMO.
There's family pressure often.
A lot of front row family pressure.
I know.
And it's not like the same sort of media attention, front page media attention is given to the stock market, despite it generating just as good a return, if not historically slightly better returns than property. And so I think that's where that anxiety comes from. If I don't invest, if I don't get that family home, if I don't buy property, I'm missing out. But it's not the case.
Not the case. And, I get really disheartened when, we have chats with people that reach out to us and they feel really shut out by the property market. I'm not going to say that it's not hard. It is really hard. But it's not to say that you can't do it. You just need a plan. And the first property you buy may not be an apartment or a house in Bannington. Right? It could be an investment property in Brisbane to get you on the property ladder. I genuinely do think that there's pros and cons for both. The thing to think about, even kind of leaning into that question a little bit more around kind of down the track and retirement, you also don't have to own a property in retirement, but you've got to think about, in later in life, do you want to be living in a property that you own? And for a lot of people, the answer is yes, for that sense of security. So that's why, again, the property piece does come up a lot. It's put in a lot of headlines across all media outlets because of the emotional charge behind it.
I think that the other part of that consideration, though, is that there's a lot of government policies that preference owning a home in retirement. Like it's not counted towards the age pension test and it's tax-free and all of that stuff. Whereas if you had that similar amount of assets in a income-paying investment, then you would be assessed differently.
Yeah, definitely.
Does that factor into your thinking when you're talking to clients who are getting older?
Our clients are not retiring for about 30 years, so ask me in about 20.
Okay.
But does it factor in their 30s? No. Again, I can talk to that demographic because that's who we work with. The property piece, typically, even those that are adamant that property isn't a thing, it does. From what I've observed, typically when people look to start a family, that's when it does become a bit more of a priority. For those that want true flexibility and potentially, a family isn't a priority for them, then there's no reason why a stock portfolio allowing for that true flexibility isn't a way to achieve that.
And just to close out on the property piece, although I'm sure we'll have plenty more, one of the questions was at the start, property or shares. How do you generally speak to clients when they come and they say, I want to buy this property in Paddington or whatever, and it'll be all eggs in one basket. I'm just going to pay off the mortgage. Like, are you generally saying there should always be investment outside of property as well?
So the first thing that we would do, if they were looking to buy a property in Paddington, given that that's going to have a pretty significant price tag, is do some projections. So I go, okay, if we're dropping 2, 3, 4, whatever it is, million on a property, this is what the next 30 years looks like. This is how much we have to be spending on a weekly basis. This is how much, you know, we'll be out, have disposable income to travel. You know, the schooling options may be a bit limited if you're thinking about private. You know, we may not have the cash flow for that. So it's giving them an insight in terms of what they're signing up for. And often they look at that and they look at that future state and go, that's not really what I want. And again, I always come back to the goals, and we get a lot of people that reach out to us. One of the key themes is this theme around financial freedom. Well, I want financial freedom. I want financial freedom. And you've got to spend time thinking about what financial freedom really means for you. And that's a really hard question to ask yourself, because you're like, I don't know. I just don't want to be stressed about money. Well, what position do you need to be in order to not be stressed about money? And again, a lot of the work that we do is around helping our members define that so that we can then work out from a financial perspective how we fulfill on that.
So that, I guess, probably leads to an aha moment for a lot of clients. And we got another question around aha moments. What are some of the most common aha moments you see in your clients when they come and get advice?
First one that comes to mind is relationships and money. So everyone has different, like as an individual, everyone has different relationships with money. My partner certainly has a very different relationship with money that I do. But there is certainly an aha moment when you kind of maybe sit across the table from your partner. You go, okay, we're working towards a lot of stuff together, like whether it be buying the house or starting the family, or you know, working towards that sense of financial freedom. And if you're not on the same page, it can make it really hard. One of our best referral partners is a relationship counselor, because she says, like, if my patients or clients just got on the same page around money, they'd just be a lot happier. And it's hard, you know, having those conversations. When do you have those conversations? When do you start bringing things together? It's different for everybody, but that is a aha moment.
Well, I've got to ask some follow-ups there, because I'm sure a lot of people in the room are now thinking about their relationships.
Yeah. Maybe spill the beans. Spill the beans.
Maybe their partners are in the room and they're looking at each other.
Yeah.
Maybe the partner's not in the room and that's the problem.
Yeah.
So how do you... And, you know, you're not the relationship counsellor. You're the financial advisor.
I feel like it sometimes, but yeah.
But how do you encourage your clients to approach that conversation? And I guess what are some traps for new players? What are some things we should avoid in having those conversations?
So, you know, I've been with my partner Liam for 9 years, and early on, very disengaged, not interested. And now he's the one that's, you know, going, when are we going away for the weekend to, you know, talk about our goals and things like that.
Wine and cider.
Wine and cider. He's on the ciders, I'm on the wine. In every relationship, again, broad generalization, but there's probably one that's more engaged with money than the other. But what you're both engaged with is life and just having a really amazing, sick life. And if the one that's not financially engaged understands why you're not, you know, going out every weekend, or why you're going to Bali instead of Europe, then because you're trying to achieve X, Y, Z, then it's going to be a much easier conversation. So don't start with the spreadsheet. Start with the important bit, which is what it is that you actually want. And the thing I'll caveat with that comment is what you want will change. So don't wait until you're like, okay, this is what I want to do, and then I'm going to, and once I work out what it is that I want, then I'll drive towards it. Drive towards something. When that something changes or evolves, change the financial strategy to then drive towards that new goal or that new priority. Don't wait until your goals are set in stone, because they may never be.
One of the big disparities in our friendship group when it comes to partners and money is the shared account versus non-shared accounts. Mm-hmm. And I know it's personal and depends on how everything's set up, but what's your general philosophy when it comes to clients coming to you and asking, like, how should we be thinking about this?
Depending on where they're at in their relationship, like if they're coming to see us, they're probably pretty serious. Like, you don't go see a financial advisor with your partner unless
date one.
But for most of our members, majority of the accounts are shared, but certainly quite a number of members also do have an individual account for kind of the day-to-day stuff. And the reason for majority being shared is typically, again, those that reach out to us are at a point where majority of the goals that they're working towards are joint goals around buying property, even starting a share portfolio, traveling, you know, buying a car, whatever it may be. Typically, they're going to impact each other.
So another question that relates to, I guess, early in your relationship with a client when you're sort of working out where they are and how they manage their money. What is the biggest money mistake you see people making when they first come to you for advice?
Biggest money mistake. First thing that comes to mind is that they've been worried about making a decision, so then they've made no decision. I'm not sure if I want to buy a property. I'm not sure if I should be investing in the stock market. I'm not sure if I should change super funds. I think that's the one thing that stands out to me the most is inaction, because inaction will also potentially cost.
There's a lot of interest coming through. A couple of questions that we'll tie together here around the benefits of financial advice. Why should I go and see an advisor? And I think more particularly, and I didn't learn this until you kind of put a direct number on it, which I found really helpful, but when is the right time to see an advisor? Like, is there a certain amount of income you need? Yeah. Like, you know, a lot of us probably feel like we want it, but when is the right time?
So the reason we launched Fox & Hare is to work with a demographic that we feel the advice industry had essentially turned its back on. So when people think of advice, they think of old rich people. And the reason for that is the advice industry broadly does support people that are either retired or pre-retirement. And that's based on the fact that, you know, again, that the average age of an advised client in Australia is 58. In terms of when I believe people should seek advice or get their financial shit sorted is ASAP, as soon as possible, because some of the decisions that you make in your 20s and 30s and 40s will have huge compounding impacts on, you know, what your potential 50s, 60s, 70s looks like. And it's really interesting, like, as far as I'm, there are other advice firms in Australia that work with younger people, but they also work with an older demographic. So we very much do specialize with working with accumulators, so those that are, you know, fairly early stages. And in terms of the metric that we look at is we feel that we can show value in order to justify the fees that we charge if someone has a disposable income of about $2,000 per month. And the reason why we anchor on that particular figure is because it's, you know, a lot of our members, they don't necessarily come to us with copious amounts of wealth. Yes, some do. Yes, some have got early inheritances. Yes, some have done very well in their careers. But a lot of our members also reach out because their income is increasing every single year because they're, you know, they're pushing hard in their careers. They're moving up, you know, on the ladder, so to speak. So they're like, okay, well, what do I do with this additional income? So if we were to put a figure on it, that's generally the figure that we talk to, and that's that disposable income figure.
So we've got a heap of questions coming through. I want to take a slight pivot and get to a specific topic that affects us all, but I think the majority of us don't think enough about. And that's superannuation. So there's some general questions about just what should we do with our superannuation. A very specific one that may be too specific for you to answer. I looked into my super and it's charging me $300 a year in fees. Is that too much? So maybe if you have thoughts on the specific, and then if you go more general, how should we be thinking about super and any, I guess, tips when it comes to all of the different features of super that a lot of people probably don't take enough advantage of around, you know, salary sacrificing more into super and, you know, the first home buyers scheme and all of that.
So I love that the question's been asked because most people that reach out to us are very disengaged with their super and you've got to invest in it. You're forced to invest in it, so you may as well make it work as hard as possible for you. It is your money. Touching on the fee question, so it really depends on what your balance is. So most super funds do charge a percentage of a percentage-based fee. So high balance, $300 might be all right. Low balance, it might be a bit rich. In terms of things to be looking at, first make sure that you understand what it is that you're invested in. And in terms of often when I ask the question of, oh, what are you investing in? It's balanced or I'm high growth or I'm growth or whatever the case may be. Within those portfolios, which is what they are, no different to whether it's inside or outside super, you're still invested in underlying companies and you can access that through, so your super funds have to disclose that. It'll be a huge long, it'll be a spreadsheet that you can download from their website telling you exactly what companies that you're invested in. In terms of things to certainly look at, it's performance. How's it performing compared to other funds, fees. In terms of superannuation, why is it relevant? Nothing more than tax. So it is an incredibly tax-effective environment. So if you want to reduce how much tax you have to pay, really understanding how to use the superannuation environment is going to reduce how much tax you have to pay. The downside is if you do utilize some of those features that enable you to reduce how much tax you have to pay, often you can't then access that invested cash until you do inevitably retire. So there's that trade-off. And the government's doing that so that you're self-reliant in retirement and they're comfortable to reduce your tax bill in doing so. Something that I guess thinking about mistakes, a mistake I see people make is either they're making additional contributions to super or they're salary sacrificing into super, so looking at ways to reduce their tax bill, but they don't actually know what they're invested in. So if you're going to the effort, which is of putting additional money into your super fund, whether that be salary sacrifice or concessional contributions, make sure that you understand what it is that you're investing in. And the way that I position it with, certainly to try and get our members engaged is, you know, if you're earning $120,000 a year, you're investing nearly $1,000 every single month. Your employer is putting $1,000 every single month into the super fund that you tell them to. And that language helps them understand. I was like, oh, I'm telling them to put this money into this super fund and I'm not sure what it is. So making sure that if you are going to the effort of taking advantage of the tax piece, you understand again what it is you're actually invested in.
Who here's checked their super in the last 6 months? Oh, not bad. All right.
Nice. Okay. Sweet. I mean, they are spending their Wednesday night at a finance event, so.
It's beer and popcorn. It's not all bad.
True. No, it's all good. I think one thing that took too long to do was consolidate my super. And when you do it and you realize just how easy it is, you'll be kicking yourself that you didn't do it earlier. So if you've worked a couple of casual jobs and you've just ticked the default super, it is literally, you go to like the ATO's website, it's click a couple of buttons, they'll look for all the super funds that are out in your name and you click one more button and you can consolidate them. So do it. It's worth it.
Yeah. And it's your money.
And you're paying double fees if you're with multiple super funds. One thing I wanted to drill down on was the First Home Super Saver Scheme. It's a mouthful to say. It's more than a mouthful of paperwork to do as well, but there is a tax benefit. What do you think? Do you advise your clients to use it?
Yeah, love it. All about it. A lot of paperwork off the back of it, but we definitely do advise on it. So what is it in a nutshell? It's where you put money into superannuation, claim a tax deduction, and then you can effectively take those funds out to go towards your first home. Okay, there's a lot of caveats, eligibility thing, you know, make sure you do look into that. But you can put up to $15,000 per year, a total of $50,000, and claim those contributions as tax deductions. You've got to be conscious of the fact that depending on, it does go towards your concessional contribution cap, and depending on how much you earn will determine how much capacity you have. I'm probably getting a little bit into the detail, but it is definitely do your research on it. So the First Home Super Saver Scheme, terrible acronym, very underutilized. Because people think, oh, why would I put money into super to buy my first home? You put it in to then take it back out. So you're kind of washing it through almost in order to get the tax benefit. If you're in a relationship, the both of you can do it. So that's $100,000 between the two of you that you could wash effectively through super to reduce your household tax bill. Very underutilized, but certainly something that we often have conversations with our members about. Yeah, and it's also, if you have owned property overseas but not in Australia, still relevant. But it does need to be your first home.
So we have some people in the audience in their early 20s. They just want to know, what can they be doing at this point in their life to really get good foundations when it comes to setting themselves up?
Stay at home with the parents, which is what I did for as long as they'd have me. Because, you know, our youngest member, again, talking to this concept of like, oh, you got to be old to see a financial advisor. Our youngest member's 21. He earns 80 grand a year. He lives at home. He has a lot of disposable income every single month. So, you know, circa 4 grand that he can, you know, spend at the Paddo RSL or really start his financial journey. And, you know, he's an outlier, right? Like that's not, you know, common. Most people get to a point where they reach out to us. They're like, oh, I probably should do something and then reach out. But if you are living at home, take advantage of that as much as possible, because as soon as you do move out, the bills are going to skyrocket. Beyond that, just be really clear in terms of what it is you are trying to achieve. Again, you know, why I said I prefer shares over the property is probably the accessibility. You can start small, and that share portfolio could be a deposit for a property in the years to come. Start small and be consistent. So as much as you can, really hone in on that discipline, because that will definitely play you know, multiple returns in the future.
So this question's got a lot of upvotes. It's around HEX, and HEX really annoyed me for a while at Equity Mates, because Bryce paid off his HEX before me, and so even though we get paid the same, his take home was annoyingly higher than mine. Yeah. And ground my gears for a while, but I luckily I've paid off my HEX, so we're back on an even keel.
But not that it's a competition.
It is a competition.
It is a competition, right?
Between Bryce and I, everything's a competition.
Fair.
But I think for a lot of people, the question is, where does HEX sit in the list of priorities around getting your money sorted? Does it come, you know, before you do, try and accelerate and pay it off faster?
Yeah.
Or should you start investing, you know, buy a property, or all of those questions? So I guess, how do you think about HEX generally? And then the specific question that we have here is, would you prioritize making a voluntary payment before investing?
Great question. And this question, honestly, has only started to be asked in the last 24 months. So, and HEX, which many of you may know, is the interest, I suppose, that you pay is pegged towards inflation, and everyone, you know, based on the survey, knows that inflation's clearly been pretty high over the last couple of years. Before that, wasn't even on anybody's radar, wasn't even a thing, because you were paying like less than 1% for a good period over the last decade. It's a conversation now, so it's definitely something that needs to be considered. Last year, I think indexation was around 7.1%, which it's pretty hefty. Like, if you're building out a stock portfolio, you've got to outrun 7.1% in order to go down the stock portfolio path, as opposed to just paying off HEX. So, you know, your kind of real rate of return, if your portfolio generates your 9% and you're paying 7% on HEX, you're like, okay, I've taken all this risk on for 2%. Is it worth it? Inflation, although still high, has come down. So now it's a question, okay, right, all right, you know, the US market over the last 12 months has returned 27%. So should I be, you know, putting money into the US market as opposed to paying off HEX? There's a risk first return, right? You paying off your HEX is a guaranteed rate of return to some extent. Putting money in the market, obviously, there's a greater degree of risk around that. So it does come down to your risk appetite. And also when we talk to, are we investing versus when we or paying off HEX, what are we investing in? So if that's a broad term, but if we've got money in a high interest savings account, then, you know, the high interest savings account interest that you get is probably pretty close to what your HEX bill is going to be. So it's like, there's probably not a lot of difference there. If we then start thinking about property, your HEX bill will impact your borrowing capacity to differing extents, depending on, again, income, etc. But that is certainly a consideration. But then the trade-off is, if you then do pay off your HEX bill, well, then there goes potentially half your deposit. So it is a trade-off, and this one, without sounding really generic, is a case-by-case basis.
Well, how did you approach it if it ground your gears so much that I had higher take-home income?
No special trick or anything, just paid it off. Yeah. My partner and I bought an apartment, and we were sort of towards the limit of, you know, borrowing and what we what we thought we could service. It, massive gripe of mine is that banks are willing to lend a lot more than what anyone could service, but separate conversation. And the mortgage broker was like, well, if you want to borrow more, my partner could pay off her HEX debt and we could increase our borrowing capacity. But what the bank was offering was already more than we thought we could service, so we didn't go down that route. But yeah, it's just a waiting game with HEX. Eventually, yeah.
Yeah, good call out. I was just thinking about, like, I suppose different scenarios. If so last year we were having conversations with a lot of members, given we knew that the HEX bill was going to be pretty hefty. For those that had the cash, for those that had, you know, didn't have an immediate need for it, a lot of them did make additional payments to kind of wipe out that additional burden. For me and my partner has a HEX bill. We're not super worried about it at the moment. We've got other stuff we're investing in. It's inflation again come down, so it's going to be indexed at a lower point. It's not massive on our radar.
So we've got one here that is around saving for a property. The goal is wanting to buy in a couple of years, and we often get this through our question page as well. Should I invest in stocks, given the returns that they're giving at the moment, and liquidate them in 3 or 4 years' time to use as a deposit, or should I do something else with my deposit money over the next 2 or 3 years?
I was chatting to a journo last week in a similar theme, and I won't mention the paper, but there was a bit of a clickbait. They quoted me, and it was a bit of a clickbait title saying, millennials and Gen Y pumping everything into the stock market to get a deposit. It's not what I was saying. but, you know, if you are looking to buy property in 3 years, then putting money into the stock market, particularly the way that it's returned over the last couple of years, is a bit risky, right? Like, markets have done very well over the last 12 months. We can't bet on that, you know, playing out certainly over the next 12, 24 months. So if it's a shorter term play, then I'd be a bit nervous about putting too much into the market. That's not to say that you can't put a bit in. Like, it's not it's not cash or shares, but maybe you're going 50-50. And if the market does tank, then you go, okay, well, I want to hold on to that. I don't want to sell at a low point, that means that I need to hold on for an extra 12 months and I'm going to get the property in 4 years. So if you can be a little bit more flexible with when you want to move on that property, then potentially you can have a higher weighting towards some of those high growth assets. If you're like, no, I definitely want a property in 2 years, that's all I want, then you really can't take on that additional risk because it's that's the goal. It's a two-year goal. So again, coming back to, are you comfortable with the goal moving, or is it, no, I need it in a set time frame? If we were looking at a longer time frame, like property's not the now thing, it's like maybe in 5 years, maybe in 7 years, then I would argue you could be comfortable taking on a little bit more risk. Again, longer time frame, and generally speaking, for those higher risk investments, we'd be looking at a higher time frame to ride the wave.
I think the good news as well is we did an episode on Get Started Investing yesterday, it was released, but savings accounts these days compared to where they were 3 years ago, where we were getting 0.01% in a savings account, now we're getting 5% plus. Mm. That feeling of having your money sitting in a bank account is a lot easier to, you know, absorb, I guess, than seeing it sitting in a bank account at 0.01%.
You know, inflation is high, so yes, the cash that we have in the bank account needs to be high just to keep up. If inflation is low and the cash in our bank account, the interest that we're getting in the bank account is low, then it's like, okay. So it might look nice at 5.5%, but we also need to acknowledge where inflation is at and what the real return is. Like if we're getting 2% interest, but inflation is only at 2%, we're kind of in the same position as we're getting 5% and inflation is at 5%. So, and you may have noticed that some of the banks have started to pull back on the interest rates that you're getting, and that's on the assumption that we may see some rate cuts towards the back end of this year.
Heard it here first with the journal at the back.
Yeah.
Click back.
So, sticking on savings accounts, I think there's a lot in the world of finance that experts and professionals and journalists will disagree on. CHESS v Custodian, property v shares, they're all debates. Mm. One thing that is never a debate is the importance of an emergency fund. Mm. It's really the sort of the first step that every financial expert will talk to you about, and that's building a cash buffer so if you do have an emergency, you don't have to sell investments or go into debt. When you think about an emergency fund, and particularly for clients who don't have any cash savings and haven't thought about an emergency fund, how do you advise them to get started? What are the milestones that they should be hitting? Like, what's that first target? And then after that, and then I guess, like, what is a fully formed, you're good to go emergency fund look like?
Mm.
And given that you just spoke disparagingly about savings accounts, Bryce trying to bring some, you know, brightness to the to the 5.5%, where does that emergency fund sit?
So, like most finance people, front of mind, the go-to for us is 3 months of expenses. For those that are potentially in, you know, contracts type work or self-employed, we'd be looking at maybe 6 months. For those that are fairly reliant on rental income on their investment property to cover the mortgage, we definitely want to factor that in as well, because if you don't have a tenant for a couple of months, then that's a huge, you've got that mortgage to pay out of your cash flow. The other thing that often doesn't get spoken about, it's not the sexiest thing in the world, but is insurance, right? And we spoke about superannuation. A lot of super funds have default insurance, so many of us are probably paying for insurance already, and that is to cover you if, you know, something goes wrong. Often people think about, when they think about insurance, they go to kind of worst case. Oh, if I pass away, like life insurance. Certainly in our company, the claims that we've assisted with the most is income protection. And that's a policy that pays, you know, can pay out after 30, 60, you know, 90 days to supplement that loss of income. So that's another, it's not an emergency fund, but it's another way to safeguard you against an emergency, so to speak. So the other thing, you know, reflecting on your comment earlier, and I probably should have mentioned it, when reviewing your super, review your insurance, make sure you really understand what you are covered for and what you're not covered for. So you can make an informed decision as to whether that's relevant. And don't just think of the now, like, oh, I don't think I need it now. I'm still living at home or whatever the case may be. Think about also future state as well, because you don't want to cancel a policy that you may not be able to get again.
Let's test my memory. There are three types of insurance you can get in super.
Mm-hmm.
Death, mm-hmm. Total and permanent disability, and income protection.
Yeah.
So what are obviously it's going to depend on people's individual circumstances and, you know, their family situation and their job situation.
Yeah.
But when you say people should go and review,
mm-hmm.
what should they be looking at when they and thinking about when they do that review?
Yeah.
And then outside of those three insurances, are there any other insurances that that matter for people in their accumulation phase? Obviously outside of like car insurance and health insurance, but any other insurances that should factor in?
We talk about insurance internally as a team so much, and our members, they're like, oh, why are we talking about insurance again? And I'm going to be really honest, it's boring. Like, I don't enjoy talking about it, but it's really
it's boring
bloody important.
Until it's not.
Yeah.
It's boring until it's the most totally. Important thing in your life. Yeah. The
biggest mistake we've seen people make is they look into it when it's too late. So like, oh, something's not gone right. What do I have? So reviewing your superannuation, you're looking at your insurances. So first, income protection. So what's that designed to do? It's meant to, if something were to happen, it's meant to supplement your income. So you'll get a monthly paycheck designed to supplement your income. It depends on, you know, the way to think about it is if you did not have an income, what would happen? Like, would you move back with the parents? Would they invite you back in? Would you want to still be able to pay the rent? How would you pay all the bills and things like that? You know, people often put so much research into car insurance and travel insurance and pet insurance, whereas I would argue the biggest asset that you have is yourself, like your income, your ability to generate income. So that's the number one. The other one, total and permanent disability, so never able to work again. So, and this is a hard one. Like, if you're chatting to someone in their 20s and 30s and you're never able to work again, like, that's a huge cost. Like, that's a huge loss of income. But you also don't want to take out ridiculous amounts of cover that you may never claim on. So thinking about a figure, okay, if something were to happen, I was never able to work again, what position would I want to be in? And that might be, all right, I just want to buy a place of my own. I might want to buy a one-bedroom apartment, so I've just at least got some stability. And then there's life insurance. So life insurance isn't for yourself. It's for those that you leave behind. So partner, family, things like that. So that's really thinking about, okay, if something were to happen to you, how would I want my family and loved ones to be? What position would I want them to be in?
We actually did an episode recently on insurance and what you should be thinking about this age. If you haven't listened to it, it was great, because I'm actually desperately uninsured when it comes to that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
My super fund, I'm with Superhero, and for some reason I just don't have any insurances through it. I think I was signed up when we were beta testing or something. I don't know, but
I have all the insurances. I think it was user error. Bryce claims that it wasn't.
Anyway, I don't have insurance. And one of the things that I kept grappling with was, you know, I definitely need all these, self-employed especially income insurance, those sorts of things. But I had, you know, I was like, damn, this is going to really hurt my cash flow.
Mm.
And then I learned through this process that if you don't have it in, you're in a super fund, you can still go externally and have your super fund pay for it,
mm-hmm.
or it's a tax deduction for income insurance.
Correct.
So that was like oh, great. It's not going to kill my cash flow.
Yeah.
I should go out and actually do this.
Yeah. I believe it's as important to look into as an emergency fund. It's just another emergency fund, essentially. And again, a lot of super funds do have you paying for it by default anyway. So you may as well know what you're paying for and whether that's the right cover for you.
One question that I like that's come through is challenging something you've said earlier, Glenn. And, you know, we're all for the debate here. So
totally.
if you disagree with anything that's been said...
meet Glenn out the back.
Yeah. Yeah, try and write it in Slido. If there's not enough characters, just stand up and yell at us. But this is about your preference for shares over property.
Yeah.
And James writes, historically, shares outperform property per annum, but when you factor in the leverage in property, does this not shift your opinion on overall return?
Yeah, leverage is a huge, huge advantage for property. But my rebuttal to that is there's no reason why you can't leverage shares. Just people don't.
How would you do it?
So how I've done it before is actually used equity in property to invest in shares. No risk of a margin call because the security is property and you're not going to be paying ridiculous margin loan lending interest rates. You're going to be paying property interest rates.
Just need a property.
You just need a property.
What about for those that don't have the property?
Don't have the property. And the question is, do we leverage to buy the property?
Or, well, you were saying you can leverage to buy shares as well.
Yeah.
And I'm sure some people's ears picked up at that.
Yeah.
But if they don't have a property, what can they do?
I just think there's, again, I come to the fact that there's pros and cons for both. So, yes, shares have returned better. Yes, you can leverage into property. I love the flexibility when it comes to shares. Like if you buy a property, you can, you know, you can't sell a bathroom or, you know, it's a huge, you're kind of in or you're out. The other thing is transaction costs associated with property are massive. You know, the stamp duty you have to pay, and then you've got to sell it, you know, get an agent to sell it for you. And then there's also just the general upkeep of a property, you know, whether that be your strata and things like that.
So just to build on that and our experience with leverage for anyone thinking about it, and I think if you're at a beginner stage, you know, it's not recommended, but I think if you find the right products, it does have its advantages because I was at a point, you know, a number of years ago when I couldn't afford to buy a house, but I could have, I had an income where I could afford to service a loan, not to the extent of buying a house, but I was like, I want to be able to get my money to work now. And we were fortunate enough. So there's a product called NAB Equity Builder, which functions exactly like a home loan, but specifically for stocks. So it's not like a margin call where you'll get called if your stocks go down, you have to put money in. It's a fixed repayment every year over a number of years. I think you can choose the duration, 3, 5, or 10 years or whatever it may be. And there's a defined list of investments. And so it gave us the opportunity to say, look, I can't afford a home loan, but I could afford to pay off, you know, 10 or 20 grand in shares or 50 grand or whatever it is and just get that feeling that our money's going to work. And then you pay that off and then you have like a nice chunk of shares and away you go. So I'm not saying it's for everyone, but there are products out there that give you the ability to get in.
I think the one key thing about the NAB Equity Builder, because it was a great product, but when we signed up, the interest rate was like, what, 3%?
3%. Now up at 9%?
And so when the interest rate was at 3% and you think, all right, well, the long-term average of the stock market is between like 8 and 11%, depending on the market, and I'm paying a 3% on this loan, like that maths made sense. When the interest rate is 9%, then your sort of your expected return isn't as good. The maths doesn't add up as well. But if we see interest rates cut and the interest rate on that loan goes down, have at it. Not personal advice. Yeah.
A few here that are all kind of tied into the same, but just prioritizing extra repayments to mortgage versus investing in the share market versus offset account, tying all of that together.
You're probably sick of me saying this, but what are we trying to achieve? Like, you know, often making additional repayments on a mortgage, not a bad strategy, I'd argue a fairly conservative strategy. And if we're making additional repayments off the mortgage to be, you know, debt-free in 10, 15 years, well, the question is like, well, then what? What do we then just, do we then start investing? And it does depend on interest rates. So, you know, ask me this question 3 years ago, I'd be like, well, interest rates are pretty low. We probably not a lot of value in making, you know, considerable additional repayments. We'd probably look at favouring, you know, the stock market, where interest rates are now. If you just look at kind of the average return of markets versus where interest rates, the differential and what you're actually getting is a lot less. In terms of offset versus repaying the mortgage, without taking this on a huge tangent, if you've got a property and you're living in it, it's your home, and you're thinking that may become an investment property down the track, you may look to accumulate funds in the offset account, reducing how much interest you have to pay. If you were to then buy a second property, you could take the funds out of the offset account to buy that second property, which is your owner occupied, keeping the amount of deductible debt against that investment property as high as possible. That's probably going on a bit too much of a tangent, but there's things to consider when thinking about not just the first, but also the second and the tax considerations.
Now, Glenn, we've got heaps more personal finance questions. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get to all of them. There's heaps on ethical investing and brokers that we will get to. Before then, I want to take a break from the personal finance content and ask about, I guess, finance policy more generally. We got a question in, and the name is, I've lost the question, but I remember it. So apologies, I don't have your name. If you were Prime Minister for a day, what financial policy would you change?
Now I'm stumped because none of our members have asked us this one. What policy would I change? One I wouldn't change is around accessing superannuation. I get really nervous when the government starts to talk about accessing super, to be frank, for any reason. So that's one I wouldn't change. Maybe the policy would be able to never be able to change that one. Financial literacy at schools. Thinking about where financial literacy is in Australia, and again, you know, everyone is taxed, everyone, you know, money isn't the important bit, life is the important bit, but money touches everything. And unfortunately, we don't get taught this stuff at school. Again, I love the fact that everyone spent their, you know, Wednesday evening with us, but that isn't the majority of Australia. That's shit. People need to be engaged with their finance to be able to live the life that they want to. And that's everything from how we're taxed to how we manage the day-to-day to what is a share to what is this superannuation thing. So mandated financial literacy in schools.
Love it. I'm going to put Bryce on the spot. What would you do?
I would do no negative gearing, I think.
Okay.
Sack negative gearing.
So you'd be voted out at the next election.
Yeah.
That wasn't the question. If it was what do I need to do to stay Prime Minister, I would increase the benefits of negative gearing and give all first home buyers an extra 50K.
Yeah.
What would you do?
Oh,
I
was getting ready to ask the next question. I think financial literacy is a big one. I think the fact that the only financial literacy in school is Commonwealth Bank selling you their products and learning compound interest formulas in maths is such a great shame. There's 12 US states that have now mandated personal finance literacy courses before high school students graduate high school. I think that's just a no-brainer. And I think there's questions about how well it would be taught in school and who would be teaching it and all of that, but I think they're all details. I think the policy is really important. But I think house prices, I agree with you. I think it is the biggest blight on Australia's economy at the moment. It's got to be solved. Sorry if you own property, but, We all own property. It's got to be solved. And then the other one is a resource super profits tax. Compare Australia's resource wealth to Norway's resource wealth and compare how the tax systems and then what comes out of those tax systems, it's just like chalk and cheese. So there you go. I'd get voted out straight away.
Yeah.
All right. We mentioned earlier that the most common question we get at Equity Mates is what broker should I sign up with? So we got a question from Alana.
A couple in there about brokers.
We got a couple in there. But this one in particular.
I get really nervous when people start talking about product.
We can talk to it if you want.
Yeah, you can.
Well, the question is, what broker do you use? If you don't want to specifically answer that, How do you when a client comes and they haven't signed up for an investment account?
Yeah.
How do you guide them?
First thing is cost. That's the first thing that comes to mind. Again, thinking about the demographic that we work with, investing is often, they might have started a portfolio, but they're still fairly early on in their journey and cost just erodes returns. The platforms that we use depend on the member. So if a member wasn't super engaged with their money and they wanted to kind of outsource that investment piece, we would pick a platform that potentially has a higher cost point, but we could manage for them because they know that they're just not going to do it if they didn't. In terms of, you know, members that are probably more self-directed, there's a number of platforms that have been, that have come out from fund managers, ETF providers that are very, very low cost. It does limit what you can specifically invest in, but it does enable you to access quite a diversified range of investments at a very low cost.
I mean, we can
have
be
I
specific.
Skipped around that.
No, 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 you've done well. You've done the question well. Was what broker do you use? No, that's okay. We understand. I think if we can put our own experience to it, we use multiple brokers just based on the journey that we've been through. We both started with CommSec because we were signed up with the Dollar Mines when we were young, and that's how we started our journey. And then over the last 5 or 6 years, there's just been a proliferation of tech platforms coming online. So I think if you're just starting your journey, there are a number of online platforms available now. We both use Stake and Superhero as sort of like primary brokers. Yeah. And the reason for that, I think, is Superhero has an automated investing function that we find incredibly useful when it comes to taking the emotion out of investing. Every time we're paid, a little bit goes into our broker account, and then Superhero just invests it every fortnight. We get a text message that says, congrats, you've just bought X stocks, and we don't have to do anything. So that's a feature that, if that's the type of investing that you want to do, then I'd look at that feature. Similarly, like to Glenn's point, cost, both have super low cost brokerage. So depending on what you're buying, ETFs, Aussie stocks, US stocks, they're not paying anything over sort of $3. So that's my personal experience, and I think similar to Ren.
For me, it's the first decision that every investor makes, and it's so confusing because there's so much choice. It's the classic example of the paradox of choice. The more choice you have, the harder it is to make a decision. But it is the dirty little secret in Australian finance that all of these brokers are trying to differentiate themselves. They're trying to tell you that they're different or they're better or that they're more helpful. They are selling exactly the same thing. And hopefully there are no people that work for brokers in the room, but it is true. Like, if your broker gives you access to the Australian share market, you're buying exactly the same products or exactly the same companies at exactly the same prices. The idea that, like, the broker makes the difference. It's not like, you know, you get double BHP dividends if you buy through Stake, or it's not like there's exclusive ETFs only to Superhero. There are so many options, and most of them are absolutely fine. So whatever you choose, you're probably going to be fine.
Yeah, totally agree. And, you know, if you're putting $200 into that account, regardless of what it is, versus 100, that's going to have a much bigger impact as to whether you're paying $5 or $6 for a trade. And the other thing is, in terms of platforms that I probably steer away from, is those micro investing platforms. And I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with them. So Raise is one that comes up quite a bit. Why do I like them? I feel like these platforms have enabled people that have been very that have felt that investing in the stock market wasn't right for them. So it's made it very accessible, which I love. What I'm challenged by is the fact that a lot of, certainly the conversations I have, is that those that are using the platforms are not really sure what it is they're actually investing in. They're picking the growth or the high growth, but they're not really sure what they're actually investing in. And also, again, you know, even the roundup functionality and things like that, I think it's kind of a bit of a gimmick in that, is that actually going to get you to where you want to be? So not a bad little feature, but I do think it's a gimmick as opposed to getting you that sense of financial freedom.
Glenn, just a massive thank you for coming tonight and answering everyone's questions. We really appreciate it.
No worries. I hope it was helpful.
I've also forgotten two important things. One big thing is a favour from me. If you enjoy the podcast, I've got to give a shameless plug. If you can just rate and review it, we would really, really appreciate that. It goes a long way to helping us get in front of new Equity Mates listeners. So if you could just do that on your way out, our doorman Alf will be making sure you do that to get out of the building. And also, if you have enjoyed listening to Glenn, you can scan this QR code and it'll go through to our website, and we'll be able to connect you directly with Glenn and the team. He's, as he said, based in Tassie, and the team is all over Australia. So I know we're obviously in Sydney now, but if you also know anyone looking for advice, they're Australia wide. So there's the code, and also the team will be out the back if you want to have a chat to them. So again, appreciate you guys coming. See you out the back.
Thanks, everyone.
You have been listening to an Equity Mates Media production. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This podcast is intended for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general advice only and has not taken into account your personal financial circumstances, needs, or objectives. Before acting on general advice, you should consider if it is relevant to your needs and read the relevant product disclosure statement. And if you're unsure, please speak to a financial professional. The hosts of this podcast and their guests may have positions in the companies mentioned. Equity Mates Media operates under an Australian Financial Services License 54067. 697.